You got to have a big why. Not a what, not a how, but a why. Because whatever your journey is, you're going to hit roadblocks, you're going to hit naysayers, you're going to hit setbacks, you're going to get wins, you're going to knock a few out of the park. But what's your guiding compass? What's your guiding light? Why? Why are you doing this? Sometimes problems are interesting, but you don't have a big enough why to solve them, right? So maybe you got to keep looking for a different problem set.
Welcome to the Problematic Podcast, a show that gives you the chance to be the hero in helping solve some of the world's largest problems. Find out which teams need your skills today at problematic.app. And now, here's your host, Sean Tierney.
All right, today on the podcast, I have a conversation with my friend and former boss, Josh Strebel. I've known Josh and his wife, Sally, for about 15 years now and had the pleasure of working with them for about 4.5 years at Pagely as the head of sales for them. In this conversation, we cover a lot of ground, but it's a lot of lessons, how you make the transition from moving, from a consulting company to becoming a products company, the trials and tribulations in the early days of, you know, getting through that chasm when it's just you, what that's like, temptation to raise money, hiring people, firing people, pricing lessons, the something called the Halo Car, which is a really interesting way of bracketing and lifting up, being able to elevate your pricing, onboarding new employees, culture, just go through a ton of stuff. So really interesting conversation. I want to make one quick commercial before we get into the episode, and that is we now have the Bounties program, which is live on Problematic, the website. And so what this is, we've got 8 bounties seated, over $8,000 worth of rewards there, tackling various issues. And these are things like climate change, urban sustainability, mental health, isolation and loneliness, lobbyists, scams targeting the elderly, social media toxicity, all kinds of issues there. And we have a pair of events coming up in Lisbon. That's going to be happening September 23rd and October 7th. If you're not in Lisbon, we can always use remote feedback volunteers. And so if you're listening to this, wherever you are, and you want to participate in that as a feedback volunteer, you can potentially earn stake in the projects that are being developed at these next events. You can also contribute asynchronously and remotely to any of the open opportunities that are on the website. The project leaders now have the tools to post basically little challenges and tasks of stuff they need built. So requests for deliverables. And so all that stuff you'll find on the website. It's problematic.app. And if you'd like to be part of the events, we would welcome anyone who wants to participate. We soon have the ability coming to actually organize an event in your locale. So you can bring Problematic to your locale using our website, using the platform. It's basically like a little Wikipedia style. Anyone can extend it and bring it to their own neighborhood. So all of that is coming soon. And with that said, please enjoy my interview with Josh Strebel. Hey everybody, this is Sean with the Problematic Podcast. I am here today with Josh Strebel. Josh is former co-founder and CEO of Pagely Inc., the first to market and leading managed WordPress hosting provider serving the upper mid-market and enterprise. Their clients included Cisco, VMware, Disney, Warner Brothers, New York University, and the U.S. federal court system. Pagely was acquired by GoDaddy in November of 2021, and Josh has since completed his obligations under the acquisition and gone into early retirement. He now lives in Tucson, Arizona, or has lived in Tucson, Arizona, with his wife and co-founder Sally and their two children. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, what's up, Sean? Good to see you again, man.
Good to see you, man.
When you say early retirement, it makes me sound like I'm like this old bucket. Like, oh yeah, he's been put out to pasture.
Yeah, I want to see the golf shoes and the umbrella and the sunscreen and all of it, man.
Yeah.
All right. So my listeners don't know who you are. Can you just give a quick backstory? And I'm actually going to preface all this. There's an excellent interview that you did with a mutual friend of ours, Greg Head. I highly recommend if you're listening to this, I'll put the link in the show notes. Go listen to that because that's got really kind of like the origin story and all the lead up and the kind of the, you know, really the overview of Pagely. What I would like to do with you today is really drill in on some of the lessons that might be relevant for our listeners. But first, can you just kind of give a little who are you and what was Pagely?
Yeah, I'm 45. 20 years ago, I graduated college on Friday, married Sally on Saturday. For all intents and purposes, we started a company that Monday. We were doing light web design, SEO, etc. And then we eventually found our way into hosting. And I know I'm compressing time right now, and we can dig into that later. But we found our way into hosting WordPress sites. And then about 15 years of that, we exited recently. And the whole time, Sally and I were husband and wife, and we were co-founders. And so there was an interesting power dynamic through all that. And I know you were there for 5 or 6 years of it. We got the pleasure to work together. And it was quite the merry band of pirates, I'd like to say. So
I can attest to that. I think I was there officially 4.5 years, but it was an amazing ride. And I think that's what's cool. It makes this interview a little different than most. Normally, I'm interviewing people where I have no inside information. But obviously, I was there for part of it, and it was pretty epic.
It was fun. You know, Joshua Eichhorn, who was our CTO, I was talking to him the other day, just shooting the shit. And he's like, Josh, it was the most fun I ever had at a job, like working with you for all those years. And he was with us for several years. He's like, just so much fun, just so loose, so easy, so interesting, engaging. So, I mean, that was music to my ears.
Yeah, I would echo that, man. I would say of the jobs, and I've had a lot of them, it was definitely the funnest job that I've ever. I never even thought of it as a job. Like you had reached out to me when I was kite surfing down in Mexico, and we had a Zoom call or something, you know, with like birds in the background and stuff. And you're like, "Come run sales," and I'm like, "I don't know." And man, that was definitely one of the best decisions I made.
Oh well, thank you. It worked out.
Cool. And then what about Pagely? Can you just give kind of, and again, if you're listening, I highly encourage you to listen to the other interview, but like for the folks who aren't going to listen to that, what does Pagely do?
Pagely is managed WordPress hosting. So obviously most people know what WordPress is. It's an open source content management system. It runs 30 or 40% of the web. Well, back in the early days in like 2006, WordPress was just getting started. It was just this little thing. And we had an idea to kind of automate some of the technical install and updating and security things for it. And so we became the first managed WordPress host. And we were fortunate timing-wise because as WordPress, the open source product, was taking off and being adopted by web designers, we were the first ones there offering a technical managed solution for it. So A, we were badass, but B, we also rode the wave. And the timing was just perfect. And so that was there's some luck there, you know. But yeah. over time, the market became more saturated. More players came into the space. So you could get it for $2 a month, $10 a month, $100 a month. Where we differentiated is we went B2B enterprise. And so we were talking to the Disneys, the Warner Brothers, the VMwares, the Ciscos. And we were doing the most complex sites, the biggest needs sites. And so, you know, higher margin, but lower volume. And that was where we kind of really excelled in that customer-centric product quality of service aspect of the market.
Yeah, for sure. I always said high traffic, high criticality. It's like, if this cannot go down, then it's Pagely.
You know, what's funny is a website's important to everybody, right? But like when an issue happens, the average realtor or the average e-commerce person, like, he's losing real money. Like when his website's down, he's like, yo, I'm losing $20 a minute in sales or $50 an hour in sales. And it's real to them because that's a small amount. That's all they have sometimes, right? And so they will freak out during an outage, like, oh, my site's down, you're costing me my livelihood. But these big massive companies, you know, Amazon will go down for 2 hours. They won't even notice. And we'll email them later and say, hey, there was this event and this is how we took care of it. And like, yeah, thanks for handling it, dude. That's why we pay you the money. And so, you know, it's weird. It's like their site is still critical, but they were mentally prepared that nothing's perfect. There's always going to be an issue. No drama. That's what I'm paying you for, Pagely, just to take care of that. But the lower end customers, it was literally life or death. And we'd hear from them, like, you know, the phone lines would blow up if there was an issue. It was just interesting psyche of the different customer segments.
Well, I want to, at some point, we'll get to the snafu. I don't know if you remember when the domain lapse on the HA domain. We won't go there yet, but in terms of phones blowing up, that will be a fun one to talk about. But let's rewind like to the very early days. So you're doing a consulting business, which was OBUweb. How did you, A, see the opportunity to build Pagely? And then B, how did you transition out of OBUweb, like from a services to a products company?
Oh, great question. And it's one of my favorite things to say, because, again, this is where my amazing wife and partner, Sally, was instrumental to it all. So 2005, 2006, as you said, we were doing light SEO, light web development. We were building sites in Dreamweaver. We were cutting Photoshop documents into GIFs and putting them in table layouts in Dreamweaver. And we had the one pixel transparent spacer GIF that we'd size. And, you know, that's how shit was built back then. Well, this WordPress thing, as I said, came about. And it's a content management system. And in the early days, it was just kind of blogging. But there was this thing that, like, wow, maybe you could build websites with it. And so we were slowly going up market with our agency business. And so, you know, we were going from $1,000 websites to $10,000 websites to, you know, hopefully eventually $20,000 websites and such. And so we're getting these phone calls from our customers that we had a few years prior. And they're like, hey, need another website, Josh. It's still $500 or it's still $1,000. And I was like, nah, our rates have gone up. We can't do that anymore. Well, you know, long story short, Sally's like, you're saying no to this money. You have these customers trying to give you money, but you're saying no to it. So why can't we make them a website for this amount of money? Why can't we service this customer segment? And again, this was her idea. And so, you know, rather than just say, well, it's impossible, we were open. And we're like, well, how could we do that? What would that look like? And so Joshua Eichhorn, our CTO later, but he was our employee, just a developer back then, he sat down and wrote some PHP scripts, and we leveraged the Plesk API, and we figured out how to, like, build a website that showed some thumbnails of a potential website design, and you put in some information and a credit card, and out the other end came a WordPress site. And we did the install, we did the database setup, we did the files management, you know, the low-level technical stuff that at the time everybody had to know. If you wanted to build a website, you had to know what a database was, you had to know how to set up FTP, you had to do these things. But we did it all for you. And we called that Flare 9, which is a weird name, but, you know, that's what it was. And we started giving it to our customers. And, you know, next time I got a phone call and they're like, hey, build me a website, hey, we can do that, and we'll put it on this new hosted product or platform that we have. And we got 40, 50 customers on that, paying about 40, 50 bucks a month or something. But then we didn't know what to do with it after that. We didn't know how to market it. We didn't know how to promote it. This is pre-Twitter, so it's not like you could just go talk about it. We could blog about it, which we were doing, but it was mostly like through meetups and, you know, Refresh Phoenix and stuff like that, that we would be evangelizing it.
The back of petty cabs at South by Southwest.
Well, that was Pagely, right? That's where came. So then 2008, you'll remember the market here in the States. It was, you know, the great financial disaster, whatever the fuck they call it. What's the name of it again?
Financial crisis, I think.
Yeah. It seems like it's just been a constant crisis, but... So 2008, market sucked. I was winding down the agency business. It was literally just me doing solo consulting, and I had a few development clients I was doing work for. But I was like, man, I can't keep selling time for money. Even if the contract's 50 grand, I'm still committing 6 months of time, of effort, labor to that, to earn that 50 grand. There's got to be a better way. And so we had the idea to take that hosting business that still had customers on it. It was just sitting there. They were still paying their bill every month, and turn it into something. And so we registered the domain page.ly, because the .ly domains were cool back then. And I built in public. So this was Twitter now, and on the blog. And so I would take screenshots and then share them on Twitter and like, look what I'm doing. I'm building this thing. It's a WordPress hosting platform. And look, now there's email and now there's domain registration, you know? So I built like this little website builder platform and I did it all in public. And so towards the end of September 2009, when I launched it, when we launched it, we instantly had customers. And within the first couple months, we had a couple hundred new customers and it was like $20 or $15 a month. And then we were off and running, right? So I wound down, well, it took about another 6 months and we got up to some sizable revenue. We were making, you know, $500,000-$600,000 a year in revenue. And that was when it was like, Sally, I think we have a business here. And she says, yeah, dummy, we have a business here. Let's stop consulting. And we're just going to do this now. And that was where, you know, kind of Pagely came from. It came from the design space for an effort to make recurring revenue and stop selling time for money and to service a wide customer base with an opportunity of a new content management system. And we just kind of rode that wave and it all fell together and we made some mistakes, but we had a lot of fun. And yeah, that's essentially where Pagely came from.
Yeah. So it sounds like it was born out of the desire to not turn away customers that you had, even when your time was worth more than that. So you're really saying like, how do we continue to service these guys? But then also combined with at some point you had that like, oh, I can't trade time for money. This has to be self-serve. How could this work? And I love your LinkedIn says, like my favorite question is what if, and then how might that look if, you know, those type of questions. So it really sounds like you just asked yourself, like suspend disbelief. What might this look like if we could do it?
That has benefited me my entire career. That hubris, that white privilege, that whatever you want to call it, that naivety to say, fuck yeah, I could do that. Let's figure it out. Why couldn't we? Like, yeah. There's no obstacle that's going to stop me unless I create the obstacle myself. And that hubris has burnt me a few times, but it's also served us quite a bit. And being an entrepreneur, I think it's fucking essential. You have to have that self-belief that nothing's going to stop you. You're gonna make some mistakes and you're gonna have to zig and zag, but you'll figure it out, you know?
Yeah. Well, and in so many of these founder stories, it feels like that naivete that you're talking about was essential. Like they say, like, had I known in hindsight what would have been involved in building that company, I probably wouldn't have done it. Like, it was way, way harder than I thought. But
oh, yeah.
I mean,
but if you don't know any better, you just put one foot in front of the other and you solve the problems as they come up and you figure shit out.
Exactly.
Because no one's telling you it's impossible.
Yeah.
You know, you're just figuring it out as you go.
So you get this platform going. You rebrand it to Pagely. It's just you at this point, you and Sally. Like, Sally's doing the dental job, right? To pay the bills, kind of keep the lights on. And you're just like getting revenue up to the point where it supports it.
Yeah, a little bit of both. She was working 1 or 2 days a week as a hygienist. We also were dabbling in this social network thing we created called Best Party Ever. And she was kind of working on that. It's like party planning, social network. But she was also doing marketing for Pagely. And it was funny. We got to this point where her evangelizing the platform was working so well. We were getting customers faster than I could service them. And like, I was like, you got to slow down, Sal. I mean, she's exponentially better at things than I am. But I was like, you got to slow down. I can't keep up. But we got to, like I said, a couple $100,000 a year in revenue. And then I was able to hire a freelancer and then another. And then we kept kind of growing. And the party planning social network thing didn't work out. And she was down to just 1 day a week doing hygiene. But yeah, that was kind of subsidizing our life as this new SaaS platform started taking off. And, you know, so that was like late 2009 we started. And by 2012, early 2012, when my son was born, we were in a good spot. We had like 4 or 5 freelancers, contractors working for us. We were about $1 million in revenue. And, you know, I could sit back for a few weeks and Sally could have the baby and we could hang out with the baby and raise the baby and nurse the baby. And then, you know, the Pagely business was kind of working on its own. And it was, pretty remarkable to say, God, we went from nothing to here in 2.5-3 years. I wonder what we can do for the next 10 and the next 5. And that, then we just kept going after that. But
how did you get through the period before that? Because like at some point you get enough staff and enough like diversification and distribution of responsibility. But when it's just you and, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and every site's down and you've got to do that for a couple nights in a row, I imagine that was a dark period.
Couple nights in a row, a couple months in a row. It was fucking horrific, dude. Let me tell you, like ulcers, bad back. Like I just could not function because, you know, it was, I didn't know what I didn't know. And so I'm this software programmer who's never taken a formal software training. You know, I learned with Google like everybody else did. I'm a system administrator. I'm learning Unix, you know, I got to keep databases updated and malware at bay. And I have to restart web servers. And then I'm a customer support agent because, you know, somebody's got to field these tickets and, you know, so I'm wearing like 12 hats and Sally's got her 12 hats that she's wearing. But, you know, there was a point where we were growing so fast, like we were just dozens of new customers a day. But then it kind of went like this, like I'd wake up at 3, restart some servers that had crashed, work that East Coast, right? Because the East Coast was waking up. So I'd work that support queue in the morning. Then I'd find a little time in the afternoon to work on something. Then something would break. And then I'd work till 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I'd finally go back to sleep. And then Sally, an early riser, oh shit, Twitter's blowing up. Pagely's down or something. So she, Josh, get up, go back to work. And so I have to go restart some servers. And this went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, dude, where I was sleeping 2 or 3 hours at night. And she was like triaging social media when shit was happening. And it was, goddamn, I don't know how I did it. I don't know how we did it. Like, I don't know how we survived that. Because it was not 80-hour weeks. It was probably 140-hour weeks for weeks and weeks and weeks. But, you know, we got through that crunch. And then we found some help. And I was able to offload some of it. But, again, I wouldn't have done that. In hindsight, I would have hired sooner. But I didn't know any better, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess. So again, goal of all this is like, now that you do have hindsight, reflecting back on that, hiring what for support as soon as you can, or what was the major bottleneck there? DevOps, like you said.
Yeah. Our first two freelancers were DevOps and engineering, right? Cause we had, obviously the code was janky and that was breaking. So it required the DevOps to manage the servers. Well, so we looked at refactoring some of the code and improving its efficiency. And then we were improving the hardware stack with the DevOps. But then very much after that was support. Yeah. Cause you know, what's interesting is how Pagely started from a brand perspective isn't how we ended. You know, we started as the only player doing this at $15 a month. And it was a 14-year journey to arrive at the Ferrari. Like we started at like the Oldsmobile and then spent some time as an Audi and then ended up as the Ferrari of the space, you know, where it was hand built, quality of craftsmanship, huge brand, big ego, you know. So it took us a while to get there. But in the early days, hair on fire, go, go, go. Shit's going crazy. What do we do? Oh my God. But then there was a lot of fun, like you said, the pedicab, South by Southwest, I think 2010, Pagely had just launched, and Sally got us, you know, advertising on the side of the pedicabs. But here's a fun story. We called South by Southwest, and they're like, it's $50,000 to buy out the pedicabs for the conference. And so I was like, we ain't got $50,000. So she opened the phone book and she called around and somebody's like, another pedicab is like, oh yeah, yeah. I'm not under contract with South By and I have inventory. It's $10,000 and you can get like 10 pedicabs or something. She's like, awesome. We still didn't have $10,000. So we talked to Joe Stump, who was advising for a little company called Uber Taxi, right? And Uber Taxi split that ad buy with us. They put $5,000 in and we put $5,000 in. And so that South by, there was five Pagely pedicabs and five of this Uber taxi that's nobody's ever heard of, which was just doing geofencing, like geolocation testing on an iPhone. Right.
So, I never knew you guys split it with Uber. That's crazy. Yeah,
so Uber's beta testing their product and Pagely's advertising managed WordPress hosting at South by 2010. But it was great because like people were like, fuck, who's Pagely? Wow, you guys are awesome. You got all this advertising. You guys must be crushing it. No, dude, we use like a cash advance check on a credit card, you know, to like fund that. And we had to split it with Uber. Yeah. But, you know, little shit like that. You just claw and scratch.
But I think that's also just in general, one of the lessons that I took from my time at Pagely is kind of that fake it till you make it thing where, you know, if you lead the Halo car, the Pulsar plan, like if you just lead with this, yeah, this is why we charge so much money. We are this and we are everything, that it just kind of manifests its way into reality. Like perception is reality. And if you kind of confidently lead with that and enough people see it and they're like, wow, they've got like these clients, and then the clients see it and they're like, wow, we want to be with the big clients as well. It kind of just happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Fake it till you make it. That gets kind of a dirty image, because I think the social media hustlers have abused that a little bit, but it is 100% accurate. If you're not your own best cheerleader, if you're not warping your own reality to suit what you need, if you're not out there saying we're the best in class, ain't no one going to say it for you. They're going to tear you down. They're going to say you suck, you suck, you suck. So you have to say we're the best in class. We do X, we do Y, and we do it better than anybody else. And this is our target demographic. This is our audience. And so you have to like drink your own brand Kool-Aid to where it's like in your DNA, because then all the haters and the competition, they can't throw anything at you, because you're like, I'm so self-delusional right now. Come hell or high water, we're going to do this. And it worked for Pagely.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's not like fake it till you make it in the sense of like deceive people. It's like the Steve Jobs reality distortion field thing where you are just so confident in your own Kool-Aid that it's just oozing out of you. And everyone else is like, wow, this guy, he is who he says he is.
And it's based in reality, right? We did all the things that we talked about. We were capable of doing all the branding positions that we were taking. But if nobody knew about it, what good was it? So we had to really get out there and like spin this story and convince people, this is what we do. This is how we do it. This is why we're different. And I got to give some credit to this guy, Chris Lemma. He told me something about a game board once. He's like, Josh, there's Pagely and these other competitors in the space. You have to claim your corner on the game board and differentiate and say, this is my corner. And then I don't know if he told me this or I figured it out myself, but part two is that then you give everybody else their corner of the game board, right? And then you take that to the audience. And so that's exactly what we did. And we came up with these pyramid graphics, if you remember right, Skon, where it was like Pagely fits here in this category. Competitor A's over here, competitor B's over here, competitor C's over here. So rather than hiding from the competition, I put them into their corner, which was always at a disadvantage to our corner, and spun that narrative. And so it took about a year, but then my narrative became fact for the community, and it was starting to be reflected back to us. So right. The community, the ecosystem was saying, yep, Pagely's the best. They're the enterprise player. If you want B-level team, you go to this company. If you want cheap, you go to this company. It was to a T, the narrative that we crafted and disseminated out. And I'm like, fuck, this is the best marketing we've ever done in our lives. You know, so that's how we went from an also-ran or one of many trying to do $20, $25, $50 a month hosting to the premium top dog, right? It was seeding that narrative, growing that narrative, and seeing that narrative reflected back to us. And, you know, it took a couple of years, but our marketing took on a life of its own where everybody was just like, it was almost aspirational. I hope one day I have a website big enough to afford Pagely. I hope one day I have a client big enough that I can host at Pagely. You know, it was an aspirational place to be for the ecosystem and the WordPress community. Like, I hope one day I can afford Pagely. How the fuck did we do that?
Well, I know one way that you did it. You know, you're very big on events and community, and Pressnomics was a conference that you guys organized and developed a really passionate community over the years. I was hoping you could kind of talk about like that and Refresh Phoenix and Phoenix Skulls and Gangplank and all these community. It was a theme. How did that play into the success of Pagely, do you think?
Man. So let's go back to the beginning. So yeah, Refresh Phoenix was kind of somebody else's idea, but it was a monthly meetup of designers and agency types. This is like 2004 in Phoenix, right? And so it was cool. You just got to see who your industry peers were, everybody working in the tech, the web scene in Phoenix. From that, we made a few cool connections. And, you know, every time you go to an event, there's things you like about it and things you don't. And you're like, man, what if we just optimize for the things we like? So out of Refresh Phoenix came the idea for the Phoenix Skulls, which is a dumb idea I had. And like, I want to optimize for the one-to-one talk amongst professionals, the learning, the knowledge sharing. Like, let's put the egos aside and let's like, how do you do payroll? How do you fucking scale your this? How do you do this, right? Like, how do you run your business? And so I organized the monthly lunch with 10 or 12 of my competitors, just the C-suite, just the other founders. And we called that the Phoenix Skulls. And that went for about a year. And I got so much good information out of that. Like just sitting down and talking to another agency owner about like, geez, man, like this HR problem I have, how'd you solve it? You know, like, how else are you going to learn these things unless you make the mistakes yourself or you ask somebody who's already made them? And I tend to make a lot of the mistakes myself, but I love asking somebody for the cheat code, right? So I got a lot of cheat codes. Well, towards the end of the Phoenix Skulls, a couple cats showed up and they were like, oh my God, I really like this energy. And they wanted to optimize for what they liked, right? And so they're like, what if we took this great vibe that we're having once a month at lunch and just made the whole office environment this way? And then we got spare office space and we'll just invite all these companies to co-work with us. This is a mind-blowing concept in 2006, 2007.
Yeah, that co-working wasn't a thing at that point. I feel like Gangplank may have been like the very first co-working place.
Yeah, you know, give it up to Jade Meskel and Derek Neighbors. It was their whole love child, right? Because they saw what we did at Phoenix Skulls and like, we love this energy. What if we did this 5 days a week? And so they had some spare office space. So they invited five or six other companies. And before you know it, we had 6 to 10 companies co-working, habitating this big kind of shared office space. And that went through a few iterations, Gangplank 1, 2, 3, which eventually culminated in the city of Chandler giving them like a huge grant to buy a building and retrofit the building right there on Main Street across from City Hall. And you know, that was a fucking neat thing, dude. Like the first co-working, community funded, government sponsored, da 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 da. Well, then obviously we know where co-working went after that. It blew up and everybody, it was a cool thing. But it could have started right here in Phoenix, as far as I know. But through each one of those interactions, you find things you like and you find things you don't like. And each time we'd optimize for more of the good stuff. Well, the same thing with Pressnomics. There was a thing called WordCamps, which are small individual city two-day conferences for WordPress. But going to them, you weren't allowed to talk business at the time. It was like, because it was an open source product and an open source community, it was like, shh, don't talk about monetizing this. This is, you know, we're all doing this for free and for the passion of the community. It's like, motherfucker, but I got bills to pay, right? I need to, like, we got to promote something. We got to sell something. And so, like, speaking about business was kind of taboo at the time in WordPress. And so, also, the hallway track is always the best conference track, right? You can have a full schedule of speakers, but it's the conversations you're having in the hallway, which always gave me the most value.
100%.
So how do we optimize for what you like? So, hey, Sally, what do you think if we did a conference for WordPress that was mostly optimized around the hallway track? Like, how do we have these business one-to-one discussions, but as a group, make it a safe space to talk about business and WordPress? And, you know, how do we limit the speaker egos and just really make it about like knowledge sharing and circle of trust and like, how do we help each other? Like, how do we make a 2-day conference of the hallway track? And, you know, she got mad at me because she was the event planner, but I just on a whim was like, hey, I went and signed a contract for a ballroom and I guess we're doing an event. She's like, what the fuck you do? But obviously she took it over. She's like, all right, you're going to fuck this up, Josh. I'll handle this. And it became, yes, a wonderful event that Sally put on every year. And it was, what is the word I'm looking for? There's always like this officially sanctioned thing and then the rogue thing. Yeah. Well, word camps were official and they had rules and what you could do. And I'm like, fuck that. I'm going to do it my way. And I've always been that. I got this broken bone in my body that says I can't do it the normal way. I have to do it different. I have to break some rule. I have to be a renegade somehow. And so we were able to run this parallel conference with the normal WordCamp schedule, but it wasn't aimed at the user. It was aimed at the business owner. And people just really liked that vibe because we were open and transparent and we got to have conversations you couldn't have in the official channels. And obviously, you know, you get a bunch of small business founders together. It's like a little vacation for them. And we'd always plan golf and have these other events. But it really helped Pagely position and market itself as a leader in the community, as a thought leader, as a personal face. Like, I was asking hundreds of people to trust Pagely with their client work. It's a lot easier to do that when they can meet me face to face and they can see my wife and I and our kids. We'd bring our kids up on stage, not as props, but they were little. They were with us all the time. But, you know, I met Josh and Sally. They're nice guys. They're nice folks. They're wholesome, genuine people. And they put on a great event. And so now, 3 months later, when they get a call from a big client going, hey, where can I host my website? There's a higher likelihood they're going to say, you know what? I think you should go to Pagely. And then boom, we got a new $5,000 a month customer. And so it was like this long tail branding soft sale exercise to the community where instead of going to a major conference and inviting 10 people into a room and feeding them dinner and saying, okay, we're gonna do an affiliate arrangement and we're going to pay you for customer leads. And that's what the other competitors were doing. We were just very much like, hey man, come hang out with us for 3 days. Let's rock out and make and become friends. And then if you find customers that suit us, we hope you send them our way.
Yeah. I mean, I think the nerve that you struck is this, and it if anything it exists even more so now today and during, you know, COVID, is just like that need for face to face and like the humanization of an industry where most of our interactions are done through text message and emails and Zoom calls and whatnot. And there is just no substitute to being in person, drinking a beer, shaking mm-hmm. hands, just watching a band, like doing these activities together, playing golf. I think you hit that nerve and people that resonated with a lot of people.
Yeah, I think being vulnerable through it all, because there's a fine line, right? Because yes, you have to be your own biggest cheerleader. Yes, you have to show confidence. Yes, you have to puff up and be like, we're the best in the fucking world. But on a one-to-one level, you can also say, guys, I'm fucking scared. I've never done this before. I don't, this is hard. I don't know what the future holds. And being able to like run a conference where we very specifically chose the speakers and the topics. And we would always dabble in there some very like gritty, small business, like trials and tribulations type shit. Because by letting the audience see they weren't alone in the struggles of starting and running a business, dude, it made the entire vibe like so much more
Yeah, communal. It was, yes. It was like interconnected. Instead of a one-way broadcast from the stage, it was like this kind of like, I don't know, like circle of safety, like you said, or, you know, yeah. Like this interaction.
Well, because you got to put your ego aside sometimes and to really have an authentic connection with people. And we were able to do that for, you know, 3 days in a row. It was pretty rad.
Nice.
All props to Sally.
Yeah, it was the conference. I remember every time you said, this is the last press nomics until we decide we might do another one. Every yeah. single time. I think you did like six of them.
Yeah. We stopped at six.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's shift gears a bit. Something when I came into the company, I think I was only there a short period, and I had read a book and I gave it to you because I said, Josh, you are intuitively doing what's in this book. You don't know it, but this is how you're running the company. I think this might help you put a finer point on what you're already doing. Can you talk about the first of all, the book is Turn the Ship Around by David Marquette, but can you just talk about leader and what that is? Because you did it instinctively.
Yeah. So according to the book, leader is a philosophy where to run a company effectively, rather than, so I'm going to make a comparison. The normal way is all the decision-making power and the authority rests up at the upper levels of leadership. And then below that are the people held responsible and accountable for executing that vision. But they're not given any say in what that vision or what that strategy is. And so, you know, the VP who's making all the decisions, he doesn't care, or he's not near as invested in the execution of it because it's not his ass on the line. He'll just fire somebody who doesn't do his vision right. Well, that doesn't make, and according to this book's opinion, a well-rounded workforce that where everybody's engaged and moving the ball forward in the same manner. So their prescription is push the authority and the decision-making power as low as possible in the organization. So take, as a CEO, take your budgetary responsibility power and push it all the way down to the lowest level of the guy buying the pencil, right? Or the guy renewing the contract. So rather than keeping all the decision power up here, push it lower, because then you empower people to be smarter, to be more efficient, to take ownership and think. So that's kind of in a nutshell the book. And the way I got there, it's funny, as I've been thinking about this, Sean, laziness. I figured it out. I'm fucking lazy. Don't make me think. Okay. I have 1,000 decisions I have to make during the day as a business owner. Please help me make less. If I give you the power and the authority to just go handle shit, and I trust you to handle it, I don't have to think as much. So I think that's how I work my way into that. It's like, okay, these guys are smart. They've proven themselves a little trustworthy. I can push more and more responsibility onto them. I can delegate more because we had a shared vision. We had a shared value set. And then I could just stand back and let them execute against that, right? And that's so that when you show up, you're like, Josh, you have all these great high performers, your whole team. Oh my God, they're so amazing, Josh. I'm like, at the time, I'm like, oh, cool. Thanks for this book, Sean. Now I have names for all this culture stuff we have. But it turns out I was just lazy. I just wanted someone else to share the burden of making all these decisions. And I had to learn to trust people and empower people so they could make the good decisions.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I think you arrived at it a similar way to Derek Sivers, the CD Baby guy, because he talks about having this moment where, like, same thing, he's hiring up and he's getting staff and everyone's asking him every little decision, they're going to him. And he just gathers everyone in the room and he says, look, guys, this is how we operate. This is the goals. This is how I think. You take your best shot at what you think the right thing to do is, and only ever come to me if it's just like a judgment call and you're really not sure. But mm-hmm. I'm like, I trust you. I wouldn't have hired you if I didn't. Like, you can do this. And that was just like this pivotal moment where like the company finally scaled and took care of itself after that. But before then, no one wanted to do the wrong thing.
Yeah. And not to knock on corporate, where I ended up working for a year and a half, they're all afraid to make a decision. Nobody wants to make a decision. Nobody wants responsibility. They're all just about, nope, nope, not me. I don't have the authority to make that decision. Where in the small business environment, you know, Pagely, when we sold, we were like 52 employees or something. And some of these guys have been with me nine years, going on 10 years at that point. And the only way we were effective was because we had codified our values. We had codified what was important to us. We had codified expectations. And then we got the fuck out of the way. And we just let people do their job. And so, you know, we'd have big customers, or maybe we had to refund them or give them a credit. Nobody had to come ask Josh. They just knew, do what's right for the customer and be mindful of the pocketbook. These are the company finances, right? Like, if you spend them all, no one's getting paid. So everybody share that responsibility. And man, it, again, it's, maybe it started out of laziness, but it really allowed me to, allowed Sally and I to have like a company run by 12 or 15 really smart people, even though it was me and her at the top. But we had like 12 other people doing a lot of the heavy lifting and thinking and processing for us. Man, couldn't have done it without them. And they got so hooked on it where when we entered corporate after we sold, they would come to me and be like, there ain't a leader in sight around here, Josh. I'm like, I know. These guys are just used to following orders. Like, let's see if we can go lead them. But they were just so used to being autonomous and being able to be effective and like not have to ask permission. They just go get shit done. And I think everybody looks back at it. That's a really special culture we had for that reason.
I think that aspect. So there was two required readings for all new hires at Pagely. And one was that Turn the Ship Around book. The other one was Extreme Ownership, Jocko Willink. And I think that speaks to really that aspect, which is like, you know, the mission is what matters. You have, if your responsibilities are this, and there's something that falls outside the periphery of that, if it affects the mission, then that is your responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way people thought there. And I think people can say that in name only, and they'll say that's their culture, but your culture is what you do. It's not what you say your culture is. It's actually, at the end of the day, the set of actions that ends up existing. And it's just, I think Pagely had that in spades.
They got lucky.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe some of it was luck. I think a lot of it, though, was hard earned. Just, yeah, you didn't arrive at a lot of this stuff on accident. I think you had enough, you know, it was what, a 15-year overnight success?
Yeah. Yeah, it was all right. Oh, geez.
So Pagely, I think in a lot of ways was first at a lot of stuff. You know, first managed WordPress host, I would say first, like really communal centric company, but also like all remote. You guys were, you know, well in advance of COVID. Pagely was an all remote company built from the ground up. What, in your opinion, made that work? Because so many companies did not work that way, but Pagely absolutely did.
Well, yeah, so it was about 2009, 2010. Late 2010, we hired our first freelancer. Yeah. Well, so two things. One, we didn't have an office.
Well, you did. It was step one and a half on jump boxes.
Oh, that's a fun story. Yeah. Or the 1 square foot we got from Get Satisfaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we needed people, and we needed to hire for two reasons. One, we needed geo diversity, right? As we started to scale, I needed people to work a second shift and a third shift, or, you know, a graveyard and a overnight. Well, it's a lot easier to hire somebody in Europe to work your graveyard, a US graveyard shift, or vice versa, right? And it's really great to hire somebody in Asia to work the third shift, because it's a daytime shift for them, but it gives the US company 24-hour coverage. There's always somebody live. And so we figured out really early on that it's easier to hire a couple of Europeans than to try to get an American to work nights, right? And by hiring remote, we were a small company, we could play the financial game a little bit. You know, we could do them as contractors instead of employees. The Europeans were great because they would just be like, hey, I got my own little Italian LLC. I'll handle all my taxes. You just pay me this flat rate. All right, that sounds great. So I could just write it out at an expense and they handled all their in-country taxes. So it allowed us to have the 24-hour coverage. But for it to work, again, you had to have that trust to give people autonomy and to give people decision-making ability and then trust them to make the right decision. There were a few decisions over 15 years that were poor decisions somebody made and we had to clean up a mess. But I would take those two or three mistakes for the thousands that were made correctly that helped the company grow and be more efficient. The culture side of it, you know, yeah, meeting people through Zoom, it gets a little dry. You know, you're not necessarily really getting to meet people. So Sally always made it a point to organize a trip once or twice a year. One would usually be Pressnomics. We'd fly the entire company out to wherever we were doing the Pressnomics conference, and we'd spend the whole week doing a conference and kind of a company strategy session. And then we'd always do a second one. We went to the beach once. We went to Vegas once. We went to Tennessee once. And that was really nice to bring everybody in person. You can put a face to a name and you can like start learning all these funny quirks that people have, which becomes endearing because you're like, man, I always knew that guy was kind of grumpy on Zoom. But holy shit, is he hilarious. Once he lets down his little like, I'm a grumpy man persona, the dude's hilarious. Like he's one of my, this particular employee is like, I love this guy now. Like I almost didn't like him at first, but when I got to meet him in person, I love him, right? So, you know, having that in-person time, but then we'd also do weekly Zooms, standing Tuesday, 10 a.m., Pagely time. And we'd say Pagely time because that was wherever the company was headquartered, which was Arizona. So all of Europe and Asia, they would all 10 o'clock Pagely time is they knew when to do the meeting. And we would intentionally have unstructured meetings, right? We'd have once a month, yes, we'd go through a deck and like, here's the company performance, here's what we're doing, here's where we need to go. But for the other three meetings, it just depending on kind of what I was feeling that day. I'm like, hey guys, let's fucking talk about this customer. Like, what happened with this particular customer? How do you think we could do this better next time? What do you think their need was? Should we build something? Should we not build something? Should we fire that customer? Or, you know, if it was after a holiday, hey, what'd everybody get for Christmas? And we'd spend a whole hour like holding up like, oh, mom got me a little Christmas cards and, oh, I got a new Lego set or a new video game, right? Whatever the kids are into, the kids as in the employees. And so we just tried to be authentic, approachable, and personal and real, right? Again, just like in-person settings, you got to be a little bit more vulnerable and let the ego down a little bit if you ever want to connect with somebody. Dude, reducing the formality in a workplace and being more personable and approachable, it is a godsend for culture.
Yeah.
All right?
It's the antidote. To me, it's like conflict is inevitable. Anytime you're working on something hard and there's a lot of people involved, it just seems like it's a matter of time until, you know, there's conflict, mm-hmm. But the antidote is those times that you spend, you know, around the campfire and like getting to know people and talking about your Christmas presents and to the point where when it could have gone the other way, then you really, you like, all right, I like this dude. Like we're not seeing eye to eye right now, but like, he's a good dude. We'll figure it out. Like,
it's the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's the benefit of the doubt. Cause you're like, I know this person as a person and I know he means well. Or she means well, even if we disagree, we can disagree on the subject matter, not the individual person. And at corporate, they do a lot of these faux team building exercises.
Yeah, it drives me crazy. I know exactly what you're talking about.
To try to manufacture this thing. And it's like, just do the thing. Why are you doing the fake thing to try to achieve the thing? Just do the thing, be authentic. But they can't do that. You know, they can't misspeak everything. It's so performative.
You can't bolt on like this trust. Like they're looking for tools and whatnot as the answer to working remotely. And like these little, like you say, the example that I remember from iTool was like the HR lady comes in one day and throws koosh balls at everyone. She's like, this is fun. And it's like, no, it's not. Like this is stupid. This is some corporate thing that like you read about in a, you know, training or something. But yeah,
here's a fun one for you. I had to go out to the East Coast when I was working for West Coast when I was working for corporate, and I'm sitting at dinner with all these VPs and a president, and he's doing this dumb game, like tell us one thing funny, one thing that did that. And so I guess it's my turn, and these guys are all like Stanford and Yale grads. They're just like so buttoned down, suit and tie, you know, and they're all playing the game. They're all the VPs with the president. They're all peacocking and posturing to try to, you know, look good for their next career advancement. And it gets to me and I'm like, when I was 14, I ate a lot of LSD and I went out in the desert on a 2-day trip. And guys, I'm forever changed by this experience. I wouldn't recommend doing LSD, but for me, that one time, it was kind of cool. And all these people are fucking melting down. They're just like, they don't even know how to handle me. And I just kind of chuckled and laughed. I'm like, this is no big thing to me, right? But, you know, had they allowed themselves to, I think, laugh, and like embrace that and be like, oh yeah, you know, I did this in high school, or I made this mistake in high school, that little bit of vulnerability or absurdity, I think would have helped their team building exponentially more than sitting around saying, you know, I got a 1600 on my SAT. Yeah. Everybody, good luck.
Those exercises aren't going to fix trust issues and like actually giving a shit and caring about the people who work with you. And so I don't know. It's all just kind of like lipstick on a pig when they do all these things until they really fix that core issue, I feel like. Let's with the 5 minutes we got left here, let's dig into some of like the pricing and sales lessons. So can you just talk about like this halo car concept that you came up with? I thought was brilliant. Can you just explain what that is?
Yeah, so a halo car is usually like a concept car or a model or a car that may never be built, right? So Ford, you know, they're selling thousands of Falcons or Fairlanes a month. And they, you know, in the 1960s, they do this really exotic looking car that's like a jet powered car, and they'll never build it. But it's a example of what they're capable of doing. And it builds brand and people get excited and they're like, oh wow, maybe one day I could buy a jet car. But in the meantime, I'm gonna go buy a Ford Fairlane, right? That I can get today. Well, same concept applies. They still do it today, cars, whatever. But at Pagely, I just took the approach of like, how do we psychologically set a value for our product, right? Because if commodity hosting is $10 and $20 a month, but our lowest price is $200 a month, how am I going to tell this story? Because a $20 a month shopper is going to come in and say, you're 10 times more expensive. Why should I fucking ever trust you, right? You're absurd. Well, guess what? $200 looks cheap next to $1,000, right? Yep. So we would have like $200 plan and a $500 plan and six, whatever. But then we got really extreme with it and we had a $20,000 plan. Now we had $20,000 a month customers, as you know, Sean, but nobody was on like a plan that they could just click to buy. But we put it on the website strictly as a positioning saying, whether you got $1,000, $5,000, or you need something for $20,000, we can do it. And, you know, it was just, again, being our own cheerleader. We had to tell the story of the brand. We had to convey our own value. And we had to set ourselves apart from the $20 host. And so doing the halo car concept was like, we'll throw it out there. If anybody buys it, sure, we'll deliver it. But if not, at least it's a flag, a point in the sand for people to reference. Again, is that aspirational. I hope one day I can afford the El Pollo Diablo plan at Pagely, right?
Well, and if you still have the graphic, I would love it if you find this, but you had at one point made these like rockets, like the analogy of like these, it was like the V2 rocket and like the Saturn V, and then this obscenely large thing called the Pulsar.
Yeah.
That was
I think one of them I actually put the Death Star behind it too, right?
Yeah. For scale purposes.
You know, again, you like there's formulas for doing marketing at scale. I get it. Like Nike, they're going to follow their plan every time until somebody comes along and does something interesting and novel and it wins an Addy Award. At a small company like Pagely, we just fucking did whatever we thought was cool at the time, and we could be funny and irreverent, and we could poke fun at ourselves and our competitors. And yeah, so we were naming plans the Devil Chicken. We were doing shirts that had like a Yeti and a Luke Skywalker snowboarding, just whatever we could to stick out in the mind of our customer and our community. And it worked for us over time. So, you know, I know we ran out of time, but the full scope of Pagely was about 15 years, 2009 to 2021. And we went from $0 to about $9 million a year when we finally sold the company. And, you know, that seems like chump change to a VC guy, you know, who's raising a Series A, B, C. He's like, I'm going to be a $1 billion company. We bootstrapped that whole thing ourselves. We had to mind every penny, every expense. And I am so fucking proud of it. And my wife, Sally, she's so proud of what we were able to do because we were successful. We provided for our family. We made our nest egg. We made our livelihood. And we did it with integrity. And we did it with passion. And we can look each other in the eye and say, we never screwed anybody. Like, we never had to cut a corner or take advantage of somebody for us to get ahead. We did everything right. We took care of our customers. We took care of our employees, many of which, you know, say that was the best job they ever had, the best opportunity they ever had to work with us. And at the end of it, we got paid. We're living the dream, man. Like, it was just, we're so fortunate and lucky. And, you know, we caught some breaks along the way.
Were you ever tempted to raise money at any point there? I mean, there must have been a temptation when you're understaffed or you're thinking, we could grow so much faster if we just had a little more marketing budget. What was that?
Yeah. Like? Yeah, that we were floating those conversations. And two things. When I went to go look for people to give us money, they didn't see the value in what we were doing. And I wasn't able to articulate it in a way that made sense for them to want to give me to fund us. And so, you know, I just didn't understand the fundraising game is essentially what that boils down to. But then two, I got this really asshole in me that says, why should you be allowed to win when I win if I'm doing all the work, right? You're going to give me $100,000. Then I go bust my ass for 5 years and say we get a payday. Now you want your money first. You want to tell me how to do it. You want all this control, but all you're doing is providing capital. I don't know. Obviously, some companies need capital to grow and be successful. And if you want to like go be a $1 billion unicorn, you're going to have to raise a ton of money. But for me, I didn't want the pressure of anybody telling me how to do something. And so the equation didn't make sense. I can go get money by getting customers. Therefore, I don't need your money, which comes with your opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a different type of stress. We did raise money for Jumpbox, as you know. And maybe it's stressful to not have money and to be bootstrapped, but I feel like that's almost a healthier form of stress than, you know, having investors, even if they're cool. It's like now you not only feel obligated to deliver a great service to your employees to your employees, but like to your customers, but you also got to make the investors happy and get them mm-hmm. a return and juggle all this. And it's definitely another added layer of stress.
Well, and the way I always described it is like you're in a circular room with a bunch of doors and they're all open to the bootstrapper. They can go and walk through any of those doors if they want. And most of the time they can walk back into the room and choose a new door, right? But once you take the VC money, all those doors close and there's one way out and you're locked in. There's no going back. That's it. You're going. You're going this way, whatever way they decide or you decide you need to go to get scale. And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not for me.
I know you're a snowboarder. The analogy that I use is like when you're catwalking, like you're going very, you know, just hardly losing any altitude. And you could go across the entire mountain if you wanted to. But the minute you take money, it's like swooshing down and going straight down that black diamond. And now you're committed to that line. And that's where you're going now. You're not going over to the other side of the mountain anymore.
You know, and to play corporate buzzword soup, they call that a forcing function, right? Which, yes, sometimes it's probably very necessary. Shit or get off the pot. You got to go this direction. Come hell or high water. You got to go, go, go. But just not for me, and probably not for 99% of the companies out there, you know? And one thing that somebody always told me was, you only take money when you've already figured out your money machine. When you already have a machine that you spend a dollar, you get $1.50. You spend a dollar, you get $2. And that's repeatable, predictable, and scalable. Then go get the capital to just put fuel on the fire. But getting capital early when you're trying to figure out what the fuck you're selling, that's a recipe for disaster, because you got to pivot 20 times to find product market fit. Why do that with an investor yelling down your back at the same time? I don't know.
100%.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, last question I think everyone wants to know is, why are you such an FNL? No, can you tee this up? Tee up the whole saga of the effing loser. Our back and forth battle that we have.
I don't even know where it started, but so there's this stupid game that a lot of people play sometimes where they do that okay sign, right, with the camera, and like, you know, you got your friend looking. For me and you, for whatever reason, it was like, what creative ways could we call each other an effing loser? And I think I'm gonna have to say you won, because we were flying somewhere once on Southwest, and you downloaded my boarding pass, and then you changed my name to F and Loser, and then printed it out kind of big. And so when I get to the airport, you're like, "Here, man, here, hey, got your boarding pass." I open it up, and it's just like F and Loser. Oh, son of a bitch, you got me.
Yeah. But this was something that I feel like went back and forth. I don't even remember where it began, but this was like, this is kind of like our thing, is creative ways of how you call the other person an F.
Well, and I think that's where let's take it full circle. We had known each other 8 years almost, I think. And then you came to work for us. We worked together for 4 or 5 years. And then now it's been 4 or 5 years. So, I mean, you and I, we have like a 16, 17 year friendship, probably almost 20 years. But because we had that friendship first, when we were in Pagely and we were arguing about sales and where's, you know, are we going to hit these numbers? What's the, are you doing this? Am I doing that? Do you want the X? We always came back to this friendship we had where it's like, you know, God, Sean, you're annoying me. Or Josh, shut up. I'm doing my job, right? Whatever the conflict was, it was so transient, because 5 minutes later I could send you a text message and say, you know, beat dick, yeah, loser. You know, that's an HR violation, but we got away with it. It's a small company.
Yeah, I think HR was the one thing that it was like the definitely the loosest part of the company.
You know, it was funny. Sometimes the people who you'd think traditionally would be most offended were the most offensive.
Fact. Well, my man, it was such a treat to work at Pagely. It really was special. The merry band of pirates, indeed. I think that's an accurate description for what it was. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners who are people who are actually interested in working on problems? Like, as you know, I've assembled this platform. The whole point of it is to really like get people who are maybe not even entrepreneurs or experienced with entrepreneurship, but they know some skill and they're contributing to problems that they care about solving. Any parting thoughts for them, or words of wisdom, or anything else you want to tell those folks?
Yeah. You got to have a big why. Not a what, not a how, but a why. Because whatever your journey is, you're going to hit roadblocks, you're going to hit naysayers, you're going to hit setbacks, you're going to get wins, you're going to knock a few out of the park. But what's your guiding compass? What's your guiding light? Why? why are you doing this? For Sally and I, we didn't do Pagely to get rich. We did it because we didn't want to work for anybody. We wanted to be in charge of our own destiny, and we wanted to have fun. If everybody's got to work, you might as well work where you can enjoy working. So we created a company we could enjoy working at. So our why was always like wholesome, personal satisfaction driven. And so when shit happened and servers blew up or whatever, or we had to, you know, use a credit card to cover payroll in the early days, the why kept us going. There's a reason why we're doing this. And you know, so find your why. Sometimes problems are interesting, but you don't have a big enough why to solve them, right? So maybe you got to keep looking for a different problem set or what have you. The other little bit of advice is people fucking matter. I think the world is so callous, and people/employees are deemed so dispensable. But man, I don't care if you're like printing gold bricks. If you're brick handler, if you're brick layer, if you're brick wrapper, if your brick delivery driver doesn't respect you and your values and your company and enjoys their work, you're not going to be making as much money as you could be because you're not taking care of people, right? So surround yourself with smart people that lift you up, give you good advice, tell you keep it real with you. And when it comes to hiring, really take care of those people because they're going to make or break whatever your idea is. Hopefully yep. I took care of our team enough because it worked out for me and hopefully it worked out for them too.
Well, you minted more than one millionaire. I know that. And I think, like I said, it was a fantastic place to work. Josh, what's next? What are you doing after this? You just chilling for a while or do you have any plans for political office? What's in store?
Oh, I'm so retired. I'm building a 1970 Bronco right now. I'm in the cars, so I'm building a car. I'm going to race the Baja 1000 in November. That's going to be rad. And I don't ever want to work again. I don't have a why, right? I just talked about this. I don't have a why anymore. So I don't want to go through the motions of trying to start something again to satiate my ego, right? So until I find a why, I'm just going to be retired and hang out with my kids and travel and goof around and do podcasts and figure out new and interesting ways to call you an effing loser.
I'm here for it, man. Where do people, I know you're active on Twitter. Where can people find you? Or is that the best way to if people want to follow you?
Yeah. @Strebel on Twitter or saint-rebel.com is my WordPress site. And you know, it gets about one update a year.
Well, I think that blog post on the turn the ship around stuff is still on the homepage. So that should be some indication.
Yep.
All right, Josh, it's been good chatting. Have a good rest of your day. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Problematic Podcast. To get involved and propose a project idea of your own, or to join in the discussion around one of the projects proposed during the show, visit problematic.app. That's problem, ATTIC.app. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a rating and review on your favorite platform. Until next time, be the change.